All right, folks, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies, a very special edition of Torah Studies dedicated to the Kedoshim of Pittsburgh, Kedoshim, the holy souls in Pittsburgh whose lives were taken this past Shabbat. We had a memorial last night. We're having another one, and Chaz and Ben, Derek Kamale, thank you again, Yashar Koach. We're having another memorial tomorrow at 12 noon. For those that did not have the opportunity to come to it, everyone's invited to join us tomorrow at the Beltline location at 12 p.m. noon for the memorial.
What time?
12 noon. We'll do some prayers, and then we'll discuss, we'll study a class on the idea of pain and suffering and loss from a Jewish perspective. Where is God in the pain is the topic. Okay, but tonight our focus is on the weekly Torah portion. Torah portion this week is Chayei Sarah. The title of the class is Making Every Day Count. Making Every Day Count, Sarah's blueprint for meaningful living. Okay, so the Torah portion, please open up your Chumashim, Gutnik edition. This is Torah portion Chayei Sarah, and you can find it, thank you, 132 and 133. The Torah portion opens up with talking about the life of Sarah. In fact, the name of the parasha, Chayei Sarah, literally means the life of Sarah, of Sarah. And it proceeds to describe how many years she lived, and it talks about her passing. The Rebbe has a very unique way of studying Torah, studying all parts of Torah. The Rebbe's approach in Torah was always a unifying approach. Just so you know in general about the Rebbe's approach to scholarship, it was always a unifying approach. It's not that you have multiple Torahs with a midrashic explanation and a halachic explanation, a legal explanation and a homiletical explanation and a mystical interpretation and a simple interpretation. It's all one organic, unified Torah. So if something is true on a simple level, it also has to be reflected in the mystical level. The Rebbe would often talk about how Rashi in his own, by his own, not admission, it sounds like he's admitted, but by his own intention or description, Rashi says, I'm only commenting, my entire purpose of this commentary is just to give you the simple meaning of the verse. If you want mystical stuff, if you want homiletical stuff, there are other places to look. I'm giving you the simple, get through the text, understand the narrative, know the meaning of the words. That's what I'm giving you. So if there's anything, like Ben Chamish Mikra, the five-year-old who's studying Torah, who needs to know the basic story, Rashi says, that's why I'm here. That's what Rashi says. And yet, as... Huh? Well, and yet, as such a five-year-old back in the day, but it doesn't mean that if you're five, you can understand it. It means it's for the person who's, it's a basic understanding of it. The Rebbe, though, would often share talks on Rashi, known as Rashi Sichot, talks on Rashi, where the Rebbe would cite a verse and Rashi's commentary, and proceed to ask upwards of a dozen or more questions on one simple Rashi's commentary. A commentary that at the surface made total sense, but under the lens of the Rebbe's incisive scholarship, makes no sense at all. The Rebbe would rip it apart from all sides, tear it apart, and then proceed to share one core idea that changes everything, and rebuilds, and the Rebbe would then reconstruct the entire Rashi, and you would see, wow, this is amazing. And then after that was done, oftentimes, the Rebbe would say, Miyayin Ashal Torah, from the wine of Torah found in Rashi's commentary, and the Rebbe would connect Rashi's simple explanation with the Kabbalistic explanation and show how the two are truly one. So the Rebbe has a very unique view or approach to studying Torah. You can actually learn a lot if you study even the methodology. You can learn a lot from how the Rebbe analyzes Torah. One of the core points in Torah scholarship that you find that the Rebbe repeats again and again is that every name of a parsha, every name of a Torah portion is significant. It's not just we call it randomly Bereshit, Noach Lecha Vayera, because it's the first few words of the Torah portion. No, the name of a portion, it's like a title of a book, or title of a chapter, whatever it is. It has significance. It's not just convenience because it was there, so we pulled it out and we called it by that. No, it has significance. It means something. And in many different talks, this becomes a major point of the talk. And so on this Torah portion, Chaye Sara, the Rebbe asks a fundamental question. Chaye Sara means the life of Sarah, the life of Sarah. And yet, the Torah portion talks about her death, her passing. The second verse, Vatamat Sara, Sarah passes away. Right at the beginning, Sarah's passing away. And then the Torah portion unfolds. What's Abraham doing? He's burying her. And then what is he doing? He's trying to marry off his son after he buries her because he needs a legacy. Whatever it is, it's all about the aftermath of her life, not her life. You would think a portion that's called the life of Sarah would talk about her life. This is all after her life. And the Rebbe famously explains that although it would seem that Sarah's life comes to an end with her death, the truth is that a tzaddik's life, a righteous person's life, lives on after body and soul separate. Because the true life of a righteous person is not the body, but it's rather the spirit. And if the spirit lives on, if a person's life is dominated, if a person lives their life dominated by the physical, like when you think of a person, if you associate them with physical things, then that will end. Necessarily, right? No one's lived forever physically here on earth, right? So if they're associated with physical things, it will cease. But if a person's life is associated with spiritual things, those live on forever. The Torah is telling us that Sarah lived, although she was a human being, physical human being, the life that she lived was a spiritual life. And because of that, we can call the portion that talks about the aftermath of her life, we can call it Chaye Sara, the life of Sarah. Because what do we see? We see that Abraham, Avram, is influenced by her, how he behaves, what he does after her passing. Yitzchak is influenced, Isaac is influenced by her life, and her daughter-in-law that she never met, Rivka, Rebecca. It says at the end of the Torah portion that Rebecca went into Sarah's tent, and indeed the miracles that occurred in Sarah's tent occurred in with Rebecca as well. And what's the point? What's the message? The message is that her legacy lives on in her family and in the successive generations. And so the point is, the first point I'd like to mention is a point that I think is a very timely point. The point is that life, physical life has an end, but spiritual life goes on forever. And that's something that I think is pertinent as we mark these days, the Shiva of the mourning period, the 7-day mourning period following the great tragedy that occurred in Pittsburgh. I think this can resonate for us and influence us and guide us forward. Let's read a few of these verses and jump into our main topic. Tim, please get us started. 133. Take it away.
Sarah's lifetime was a total of 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. The years of Sarah's life were all equally good. Sarah died at Kiryas Arba, which is Chevron, in the land of Canaan. Abraham came from Beer Sheba immediately after Yechadah, the shock of which had caused her death. Eulogize Sarah to weep over her.
So that's all we need right now. So the opening verse tells us how long she lived before she passed away. And the Torah says, Me'a shana ve'esrim shana ve'sheva shanim. 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. The commentaries ask the obvious question, which is that this type of accounting of years is very awkward. This methodology of counting the years is very awkward because it's repeating years each time. So take a look at what Rashi says, text number 2. Ray, please read text 2. We're now in the Torah Studies booklets. We've made a clean break away from the Chumash. Let's open up the books to page number 66. Take it away.
And the life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. The reason that the word years was written after every numeral is to tell you that every numeral is to be expounded upon individually. When she was 100 years old, she was like a 20-year-old regarding sin, just as a 20-year-old has not sinned, because she is not liable to punishment. So, too, when she was 100 years old, she was without sin. And when she was 20, she was like a 7-year-old in beauty. The years of the life of Sarah, all of them equally good.
So, Rashi addresses two questions. Remember, Rashi's commentary, very important to point out, Rashi doesn't comment in the form of question and answer. He doesn't pose a question on the verse and then answer it. He just answers it. And then you have to work, you have to go backwards and figure out, well, what was bothering Rashi? What was Rashi's question? And how does Rashi's commentary answer the question that he had? So Rashi here has two questions. Question number one is, why does it say the word Shana after each segment, after each number? 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. Why not just say, Mea, Ve'esrim, Ve'sheva, Shanim? Just say 127 years. Why 100 years, 20 years, 7 years? That's question number one. Question number two. The verse opens up, the Torah portion opens up and says, Vayihiyu Chaye Sarah. The years of Sarah were, and then it lists the number, and then it concludes, the verse does, Shnei Chaye Sarah, these were the years of Sarah. That is repetitive. You started off by saying, the years of Sarah, Sarah's life, she lived 127 years. Do you need to say again, and that's the amount that she lived? We already get it. Vayu Chaye Sarah, these are the years of her life. So why repeat it at the end of the verse? Rashi answers both of these questions. To the first question, why does it state years after each of the amounts of years? So Rashi explains that it means that there's a connection between the three segments. Right? There's a connection between the three segments. What you have is 100 was its own realm, but connected to 20. And 20 was its own realm, but connected to 7. What's the explanation? So in Jewish law, famously, we know that a person becomes an adult. The age of Jewish majority for a girl is 12 and for a boy is 13, based on maturity. Now, at the age of 12 and 13, that's when a person is deemed to be old enough and mature enough to know right from wrong. Younger than that, we try, we hope, whatever, but it's not always the case. But from the age of 12 or 13, a child, a young adult, is able to know right from wrong, and then we expect them to do the right thing. But in Jewish law, the Sanhedrin, the court, would not punish someone under the age of 20. So although you are responsible to do all the mitzvot and to not do anything against the law, but you're not going to be punished until the age of, the courts would not punish until the age of 20. 20. 21 is...
That's American.
Yeah. 20 is...
I was reading that 20.
At 20 regarding sin, innocent. It means like the moment she turned 20, she would have still been in an innocent state. Right, so 100 was like the beginning of the 20th year where she was still, you know, that was the cusp of when she became liable for that. So at 100... it's like she was as pure of sin like when she was 20 or right before 20. And 20 in beauty, like a 7-year-old. Now, you might think, like, oh, that sounds like, what does that mean exactly, 7-year-old beauty? But it means, I guess, even insofar as
sweetness.
So you could say sweetness, or you could say just even physically. Like, the reality is the longer we live, the, you know, things age and whatever it is. So, like, I don't exactly know what it means, but it means on some level that that she was as beautiful or as young as on some level as a 7 when she was 20, like a 7-year-old. Okay. So that's why the segments are divided, because each one has almost has a lesson to teach us. If it just said 127, you wouldn't have anything to learn out. It's just a count. But once it says 100 years, 20 years, 7 years, it segments it. Now it's like, oh, so what's the significance? So we connect 100 to 20 and 20 to 7. Okay. And then, yeah.
The question I have is, and it's always bothered me, because it's not only for Sarah, but for Abraham and for Ishmael. It says Shene Chaye, you know, Shene
right.
Chaye. So here, Rashi says Kulan Shavim LaTova. They're all equally good, right? That's a translation.
Yeah.
But does that refer to what you said earlier? Kind of hit home that when a person lives a really good life, then there's basically two lives: the physical life
right.
and the spiritual life.
Right.
Is that what he's? What he's?
I like where you're going with that. In fact, it says that Shnei Chaye is the mark of a tzaddik. It says that Yishmael
right.
passed away. He did tshuva.
Because he did tshuva.
Passed away
right.
at tzaddik.
Right.
Exactly. So you have yeah. I think there's truth to what you're saying. The Rashi answers to your point. Rashi explains why the repetition of Shnei Chaye Yisrael. These were the years of Sarah's life. It says these are the years of Sarah's life, 127 years, and then it says again these are the years of her life. Why? To tell us that all of her years were equally good, and this becomes a focal point question. How can we say this? How can we say this for Yishmael, that they were all good? Even if he did shuva later on, how could we say they're all good? Although Rashi maybe doesn't comment that over there, but if that's the implication, then that might be a question over there. But let's focus here for a moment. The question here is a very pronounced question. And that is, we're saying that Sarah's life, all of the years of her life were equally good, according to Rashi's explanation. All of them equally for the good. Can we really say that about Sarah? Right? She traveled with her husband to parts unknown. She arrives. I mean, the story picks up when Abraham is 75 and she's a few years younger than that. But, you know, they travel and then there's a famine and then they go down to Egypt. And what happens next? Abraham puts her in a...
harem.
In a box. That's a different version. puts her in a box. Puts her in a box to hide her. You know, to keep her, whatever that box was, who knows what that box was, but to kind of like shield her away from who knows, from nefarious folk. And nonetheless, she's discovered and she's taken to Pharaoh's palace and et cetera. And all these things happen. And then she has trials and tribulations. She can't have a child. And then she offers her handmaid to Abraham. And that turns into a whole thing. That turns into a whole faribul, a whole machloket, a whole dispute. And she says you have to send them away, and there's a lot of struggle there. And then her son Yitzchak is taken for the Akedah, for the binding of Isaac, and that, according to our tradition, the news of that happening or supposed to happen, that the news actually shocked her to death. So can we really say that all of the years of her life were amazing? They were all equally good, no problem. They were all amazing. Are we just whitewashing over the reality of it? Is we just like painting over all of the blemishes and saying, yeah, it was all good? Was it really all good? There were no challenges? This is a question that the Rebbe asks on this Rashi, amongst other questions. This is a major question that the Rebbe asks. How can Rashi say, Kulon Shavim Letova, they were all equally good, when, just by what we know in the story, that does not seem to be the case? To understand this, we're going to look at a verse later on in this week's Torah portion that talks about Abraham, Avram. So actually, if you don't mind going back to the Chumash, I'll tell you what page to turn to. I always like doing the verses in the Chumash, just so we can all see where it is in context. Just so you know, after the opening few verses that talk about the passing of Sarah, the Torah then continues to tell us the story of how Abraham, how Avram, finds a burial place for her and buries her in the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, in the cave of Machpelah, which is still around today. Now, then, chapter 24 of Genesis, page 138, 139, here we have the next stage of the Torah portion, which is where Abraham sends his trusted servant, Eliezer, on a mission back home where he came from to find a wife for his son Yitzchak. By the way, how old was Yitzchak at the time? 40 years old. Okay. 139. Jillian, please read a few verses here. Oh, we could pass this. Yeah, is it better to pass?
Yeah.
No problem. Sorry, please read.
Abraham was old, but still immersed into daily life. God blessed Abraham with everything, including a son. Abraham said to his servant, the senior member of his house, who was in charge of everything he had, "Please place your hand under my thigh to swear an oath. I will make you swear by God, the God of the heavens and God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites amongst whom I live. Rather, you should go to my land, to my birthplace, and you will take a wife for my son for your father."
Okay, so that's enough of an intro that we need for this story. So Avram charges, gives his servant a mission to find his son a wife. By the way, why didn't he just tell Yitzchak to go and find a wife?
Might not come back.
You know, the in-laws, they had a good business going on. No, what's the spiritual reason?
Wasn't it because once the idea is being offered, he was holy and can't leave the land of Israel?
Exactly. Once he was brought up as an offering on the altar, although he wasn't, obviously he wasn't actually slaughtered, sacrificed, but once he was brought up on the altar, the law is if you bring up an animal upon the altar, even if you don't end up offering it, for whatever reason, something happened. Fire alarm. Oh, fire drill. Everyone had to run out. I'm joking. Let's say, whatever, who knows? Oh, there's fire on the altar. It's supposed to be fire on the altar.
You didn't hear what Dave said.
I did not hear what you said.
He was an altar boy.
He was an altar. That's good. That's good stuff. That's good stuff. He was an altar boy. Right? So once you're brought on the altar, once an animal is brought on the Mizbeach on the altar, it becomes holy. You can't just take it back home and put it back in the field. It has to remain in Jerusalem. It has to remain in the Holy Land. So the same thing is true with Yitzchak. Yitzchak was brought up as an offering, even though he wasn't actually offered, slaughtered, thank God, right? Even though that didn't happen, nonetheless, he was so holy, he couldn't leave the Holy Land. So now Abraham is faced with a conundrum. Avram is faced with a conundrum. He wants a daughter-in-law, a wife for his son, not from the locals. His son can't leave. He's not going to schlep out. So he sends Eliezer, his trusted servant. And he says, "I want you to take an oath, promise that you're going to find a wife not from amongst these people, but from my homeland, whatever, and then bring her back here, and she'll marry Yitzchak." This is a few years before online dating. So it wasn't yet so easy to find someone that lived out of town. You actually had to pick up, get on your camels, and because he had other stuff with him, as he had multiple camels. He wasn't doing a stunt where he's riding like two camels. That's no, but apparently they were better than the locals. Right. Apparently they were less steeped in whatever. Although I think really the meaning is that Avram wanted someone from his original from his mishpacha, because they were related. So he wanted someone from, you know, somehow related to the family.
Is Eliezer the first matchmaker?
Yes, first shadchan. Yes, the first matchmaker is Eliezer, 100%. You know what's amazing?
No competition.
No competition, right? Yeah. What's amazing is in the entire narrative. This is totally parenthetical, but in the entire narrative of Eliezer, not once is his name mentioned. Not once is Eliezer mentioned by name. The entire time he's called the servant of Abraham. The servant of Abraham. Anyway, it's a message. He was totally about the mission. It wasn't about him. So, the mission...
How do we know his name then if it's not...
It's mentioned other places. Oh. Yeah. So we have his name from elsewhere, other verses. But in this one narrative, which takes up a lot of verses, his name is not mentioned. He's just called the servant of Avram, which commentaries point out indicates his total dedication to the mission. It wasn't about Eliezer. It wasn't about him. It was totally about the cause, and he kind of was just playing a role, facilitating. It's like a good shadchan, a good matchmaker, doesn't go on the first date, right? Right? You suggest it. Oh, I know someone wonderful for you. Why don't you go out? But you're not sitting in the back seat, right? It's good not to take the limelight. Okay. So, the commentaries point out a very interesting phraseology in the Hebrew. As we're introduced to this narrative, the opening verse of chapter 24 of the book of Genesis says, "V'Avram zakin ba bayamim," that Abraham was old, ba bayamim. How would you translate ba bayamim? Yeah, but what's ba?
Came
of age. But yamim is really days, so he came and biz in. He came in days. It says he was old. Zakein is old. He was old. And then it says, but in addition to that, he came in days, or in his days. What does that mean? So we have a text from the Zohar, which is the primary work of Kabbalah, that explains this very interestingly. Page 67, text number 4, Marnin. We are up to you.
Abraham was old, advanced in days, and God blessed Abraham with Israel. The Barakuda opened up and said, "Happy is the man who choose and bring near to dwell in your courtyard." This verse explains and praise is the man whose ways are correct before God, and he is desirable so that God will desire to bring him close. Come and see, Abraham was brought close to him, and he desired to God all day. Abraham was not brought close to God for one day or on one occasion, but rather by his actions he grew closer to God for all of his days, progressing from level to level until he reached lofty heights. This then is the explanation of our verse. When Abraham was old and reached extremely lofty levels in his relationship with God, he was advanced in days. Literally, he came with the days. He brought with him all his lofty days, the days of faith he experienced over the course of his life. And God blessed Abraham with everything. That these days of faith became the source of all blessing and goodness in Abraham's life.
Thank you. So that last paragraph is really the key idea that we want to extract from this statement, from this excerpt from Zohar, from Kabbalah. So the Zohar explains that what does it mean that Avram was zaken, he was old, baba yamim, and he came in or with his days. What it means is zaken means he was extremely lofty on a spiritual, he was on an extremely lofty spiritual level. He was very close with Hashem. Zaken indicates not just old age, but someone who's advanced in the spiritual heights. So that's the first thing. What's baba yamim? Baba Yama means that he came. He brought with him, I'm just reading here the translation, he brought with him all his lofty days, the days of faith he experienced over the course of his life, which means that in a sense, his days were filled with emunah, with faith in Hashem, and no matter what he went through, he was always filled with a sense of closeness to God, and that's what it means he came with his days. He took... At this point in his life, he could stand up and say, "All my days, no matter what happened to me, I remain faithful to God." In a similar vein, we could say the same thing with Sarah. What does it mean that all of her days were good? Right? Rashi says, "Kulan shavin latova." They were all equally good. And we ask the question, how could they be equally good? Did she not experience hardship? Did she not experience disappointment? Did she not experience a setback or two in life? Even the Torah seems to tell us that. So the answer is, we're going to develop this answer throughout the class tonight, but the basic answer is, of course she experienced setback. Of course she experienced disappointment and heartbreak perhaps. The question though, relevant to a tzaddik is, were you faithful in those moments of darkness? Did you have faith that things would get better? And if you did, then even in those moments of setbacks, you still lived a full day and you lived a full life. Kulan, Shav, and Latova, they were all equally good on a spiritual level. Because no matter what happened, you were always in a place of positive faith in God. So good, in this new light, good doesn't mean that only good things happen. Good means that no matter what happened, you had a good approach. You had a positive outlook because you believed in God. You had faith in Hashem. Does that make sense? So that's on a... Yeah.
Is that the same thing as saying, similar to saying that he was able to integrate what happened to him so thoroughly, his faith, that it never relapsed. He never relapsed.
Yes, exactly. No matter what came his way. So the point is really, the Zohar says it's about Avram. And the way we're going to understand it, this is what Rashi is saying about Sarah. So it's really for the both of them, that no matter what they experienced, they were a certain, there was a certain equanimity, a certain type of, what's the Hebrew? Hishtavut? Is that what it's, hishtavut would be kind of equanimity? It's no matter what, despite the ups and downs, you stay on course, you stay on track. You're not thrown by the roller coaster, right? Life sometimes is a roller coaster. And sometimes it feels like we're falling off. But a tzaddik, no matter what's happening, is able to remain calm. The truth is, lahavdil, right, to create a vast separation between these spiritual ideas and professional sports, nonetheless. I remember watching one of these, you know where they take the video cameras into the locker rooms of the teams and you see the coaches like speaking to the players, and it's like football is really, I don't know what baseball does. Baseball seems like a much more calm sport. Baseball is like, all right guys, you see that white thing coming, just hit the ball and just run really fast. I don't know, right? You're not like, it's not aggressive unless you're charging the mound or whatever it is. But football is like, football is an aggressive sport. Football is like, you know, very super intense. I remember seeing back in the day, years ago, the Steelers had a coach named Bill Cowher. I'm kidding, it wasn't that long ago. It was back in the 90s. So Bill Cowher, or maybe even early 2000s, probably. Anyway, Bill Cowher, I remember him saying one line, and he was known as the jaw, because he had the jaw, and he would like it was really intense. He was a very, very fierce fellow. So he would be like really animated and say, don't get too high with the highs, don't get too low with the lows. You gotta play your game and play it consistently. Right? In a professional game, professional athletics, you know, you have mood swings, momentum shifts, things go your way and you feel really high, and then they don't go your way and you can feel really low. If you're too high with the highs, it's no good. If you're too low with the lows, it's no good. Too high with the highs, you may take your eye off the goal and you may take your foot off the pedal and you think you can coast. If you're too low with the lows, you may not even try to get back into it. The key is equanimity, staying the course, staying consistent, and doing what you need to do. So kulan shavin latova for Sarah does not mean that every day was amazing. Every day was, life brought her only, you know, amazing blessings every single day. That too, perhaps. But there were setbacks, there were disappointments, there were challenges. The question is, how do you respond? She responded with emunah, with bitachon, with faith and trust in God, every single day, despite the hardships, and thus we can say they were all lived in goodness, from her perspective. To understand this a little bit more, and to understand how we can apply this to our own lives, let's look at a very interesting piece of Jewish law of halacha. So I would imagine that everyone here around this table is familiar with the law, the Jewish law that says that when it comes to saving a life, you basically, it's not that you push away the rest of Torah, but you supersede. That's a good word. Yeah, we supersede any other mitzvah, except for three prohibitions. But otherwise, we supersede the mitzvot in order to save a life. Take a look at how this is expressed in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law, authored by the Alter Rebbe, the founder of the Chabad Hasidic Movement, page 69, text number 5. Dan, please read.
Even in a situation where given me a chance, the life will be saved. Shabbat is overridden. As the verse states, these are my commandments. A man should keep and live by them. Why does it say live by them? To teach us that a mystery should always be performed when there is a certainty for life, and it should never bring to a predicament that can lead to a question of death.
Thank you. So there's a lot of fascinating points here. That even if we know the law, I think the way the Alter Rebbe explains it in his Shulchan Aruch, in his Code of Jewish Law, is just beautiful. He says, number one, don't hesitate. If someone's life is at risk, break Shabbos. It's not even breaking Shabbos. It's do what you need to do to save the life. If you hesitate to ask, blood could be on your hands. And if you're the rabbi that's being asked, then you failed. Because you should, your community should have known that you don't ask, that you don't hesitate, that you just go immediately and save a life. So that's point number one. Point number two is you break Shabbos to save a life, even if there's uncertainty, even if there's only a chance that the life may be saved. Even when you're not sure, you still break Shabbat. Based on the verse, it says v'chai b'hem, you should live with the mitzvot. If there's any danger to life based on a mitzvah, then you override the mitzvah and you preserve life. So Jewish law talks about a case where, God forbid, a wall or a building collapses and there are people inside. And so now you have rubble that is actually laying on top of human beings. And the question is like this. Do you excavate on Shabbat or do you not excavate? Let's say, God forbid, it falls down on Shabbat. Do you excavate or not? So the excavation would be in violation, potentially, of Shabbat. Otherwise, like if you were just, you know, excavating, that wouldn't be in the spirit of Shabbat or in accordance with the prohibition against work. Nonetheless, the question here is to save a life. So here's the thing. If you know that somebody is under the rubble and they're calling out, so you know they're alive, so what do? Do you clear the rubble or you don't clear the rubble? You clear the rubble. What if you know there's a body, you know there's a person there, but you don't know if they're alive or not? What do? You clear the rubble. We said even if there's a chance to save a life, you still violate Shabbat. So here's what the law says. It's actually in the Mishnah in the Talmud. The Mishnah says that you start clearing, if you know where the head is, you start clearing by the head. And then you can assess, are they alive or are they not alive? If they're alive, what do? Keep clearing. If they're not alive, then you stop. You stop. Even though you might think you still should clear it to take the body, you leave it until after Shabbos. Okay, that we can explore perhaps in another class. But the Talmud asks an interesting question. The Talmud says the Mishnah seems to be redundant. It says that if the wall or a building collapsed on somebody and they're alive, you clear it. If you don't know if they're alive, you clear it until you can ascertain that. If they are alive, then you clear it. You don't need to tell me that. Because if somebody's alive, I know already that you clear it. Why does the Mishnah tell me in the clearing, in that partial clearance, that if they're alive, you continue to clear it? I know that already, that you clear it if they're alive. It's redundant. It's a Talmudic nuance analysis. The point is the Talmud's answer. And that's fascinating. Text number 6. This is what I want to get to. And please read text 6, page 70.
If you find him alive, you must rescue him. But if he is dead, you must leave him. If you found him alive, it's obvious. Why is the Mishnah repeating itself? But no, this repetition is indeed necessary to teach us that even if the person we're rescuing will live only for a short time, we must still break the laws of Shabbat and Hesed.
The Talmud says the Mishnah is not talking about the obvious case. It's talking about even a case that's not so obvious. And that is, if the wall or building collapsed on somebody, God forbid, and we don't know if they're alive, so we start clearing by the head, and then we see that they're alive, but it's in our based on our understanding of the condition of this person, we ascertain, we deem this person to only have just a short time to live. They are going to pass away. Then the question is, should you keep on clearing? And the Talmud says that's what the Mishnah is teaching us. Even if we ascertain that the person being rescued will only live for a short amount of time, you still break Shabbat. What's the message? The message is life is valuable even if there's only a short amount of time left. Why? Because every moment is precious. But before we come to that conclusion, the Me'iri was one of the Rishonim, one of the early Talmudic commentaries. Rabbi Menachem Me'iri in text number 7 gives a rationale that frames this law in a way that might seem a little bit exclusive, as you'll see in a moment, text number 7. David.
He began to rescue him and check his place to find that he's still alive, and we are obligated to complete our rescue. This is so even if it is clear to us that he will not survive the hour. In that 1 hour, he may have an opportunity to return to God and confess his transgressions before his creator.
The Me'iri says, why do you save his life or her life even if they only have even less than an hour to live? Why? What's the rationale according to the Me'iri? Because maybe they will do what?
Teshuva.
In other words, he's saying that the rationale for saving the life that it has a short amount of time is because maybe they'll have a spiritual awakening, a renaissance, and return to their creator, to return to God to do tshuva. Which would seem to tell us that this law, that we save a life, even for a short amount of time, is not because of the value of life in and of itself, but it's because of the value and the virtue of teshuva. What if someone is unconscious, but they're still alive, but they can't do tshuva because they're not conscious? Do you rescue them or do you not rescue them? According to the Me'iri, what would it seem? The Me'iri only says that he may have an opportunity to return to God and confess his transgression before his creator. Let's say he's not going to have an opportunity to do that. Do you still save him?
No.
It might seem for the Me'iri not, but every other commentary and halachic codifier says, takes issue with this Me'iri, as will develop. Text number 8 is a mystical text, but on point.
One minute.
Yeah.
So that means you do save him.
Correct. Okay. You were correct, but the implication from Me'iri is that we only value the tshuva that they might do, but what if you know them, there's no way they're going to do tshuva, or what if they're not even aware, they're not even conscious, they can't do tshuva, so it would seem from the Me'iri that you wouldn't save them, we save them. And the reason is because life is precious not just because of tshuva, life is precious inherently, in and of itself. Continue. Text 8.
Glad are those who have mastered returning to God, for in 1 hour...
Nah, you know what? Don't do that one. That one's still about tshuva. We moved on from there. Text number 9. Sorry about that. Look at text number 9. This is from the Chafetz Chaim. Text number 9.
The Me'iri writes on Tractate Yoma, in that 1 hour he may have an opportunity to return to God and confess his transgressions before his creator. The reality is that this explanation of the reason why we violate Shabbat to save a person on the brink of death is simply a reasoning offered for the law. As a matter of practical legal decision, however, whether or not we rescue the individual does not depend on the mitzvot they are destined to perform. The logic is not predicated on the assumption that we set aside one mitzvah, that is Shabbat, for the sake of many other mitzvot. Rather, it is simply that a Jewish life takes precedence over all the other commandments. As Samuel in the Talmud learns from the verse, and live by them, and as Maimonides writes in the chapter 2 of the Laws of Shabbat, the dictates of Torah never bring vengeance, but rather bring mercy, kindness, and peace into the world.
So there we go. The ways of Torah are ways of peace, and Torah is not meant to kill us. Torah is not meant to take a life. And therefore, you save this life, even though they're not going to live, even if, God forbid, they're not going to live for a long time, you still save the life, irrespective of what they're going to do with the life. That's up to them. We don't only save it because we assess that they're going to do another mitzvah. No, save the life because life itself is valuable. The Tashbitz, text number 10, says this clearly. Chazen, please read this one.
We violate the Shabbat even to extend the person's life for a short time, because saving a life is great in the eyes of God. To save a life for even a moment longer is more precious to God than Shabbat, which is compared to the entire Torah.
So here we have this beautiful lesson about the value of each moment of life. We spoke about Sarah and how Sarah, Rashi says, Kulan Shavin Latova, all of her days were equally good. And we explained that although she did have challenges in her life, she was able to remain, to have a certain equanimity in her life, and she was able to have a measure of faith in her life and see things through every single day. The reality is that every day does have value. Every single moment does have value. In other words, it's not just that a person can inject value in each and every single day. Each and every moment itself has irreplaceable value. Yes.
Should
right.
I jump?
Right.
And the rabbi said, stay and say another prayer.
You don't ask the easy questions, do you? Man, oh man, oh Shevitz. Man, oh man, oh Shevitz. Yeah, I don't know. That's, I don't know.
They were just pushed, they had no choice.
Yeah. But that's, but what type of horrific, I mean, think, imagine that horrific question. This, it reminds me of the story of the 10 martyrs. The Talmud elaborates on one of the martyrs. I forget which of the great rabbis it was, who was wrapped in a Torah scroll and burnt alive. But they put tufts of wool over his heart to prolong the suffering so that the flame shouldn't consume. I think they soaked the wool in water and they basically covered his heart so that his vital organs shouldn't be... shouldn't burn, so he shouldn't die immediately. He should suffer for longer.
That was Rabbi Akiva, right?
It wasn't. Rabbi Akiva was his flesh was combed, whatever it was. Yeah, with iron combs. It was one of the Chanina ben Trajan, one of the other greats. And one of the guards there said, or somebody said, why don't you take it off? And he basically said, I don't remember exactly how the dialogue, who said what or whatever it was, but he expressed the idea that he wasn't allowed to. He felt he wasn't allowed to take off because that would be expediting his own demise. Which is, I mean, that's what it reminds me of. But he said to one of the guards, but you can do it. They were killing him anyway, right? So he said, if I do it, what's my reward? So he promised him half of his share. I mean, this is what it says in one of the sources. He promised him, I think, half or whatever part of his share or, you know, equal share in the world to come if he took off the thing. But he didn't do it himself. It's, yeah. Was that ruling of the rabbi in 9/11, was it based on the notion of, what was it against suicide, or was it prolonging life, or was it a combination of both? I don't know, but I don't even know how to approach that question. I mean, to tell someone to remain in a building and be incinerated versus it's one of these impossible questions. I would imagine it was a fatal floor, and the question was this method of fatality or that, and the difference would be one is active versus passive, right? Jumping is him jumping or her jumping, and then the other one is time, you know, bring an end to it. But anyway, Jewish law says clearly that even a moment of life has value, which means that not only is it important to fill every day with meaning, but even with faith and meaning and something positive, no matter what's going on in our lives, but it means that every moment is precious. Every individual day, but even every moment of the day, even if it's less than an hour, we said, still has, in a sense, infinite value. And so along these lines, we can speak of some practical, some beautiful lessons and takeaways that we can apply to our own lives about the value of each moment and the value of each day. I'm going to read some readings, text, because we've gone all around. Text 13 from the Baal Shem Tov, Savat HaRivash, which literally means the will of the Rivash, although of the Baal Shem Tov, it wasn't his literal will and testament, but it was his teachings that serve as a will and testament for his life. So page 77, text 13, the Baal Shem Tov teaches the following. One should be sincere and consistent in their divine service. The main thing is not to forget to learn from ethical works every day, whether a large amount or a little. One should also always seek to attach him or herself to good character traits and upright behavior and not allow any day to pass without performing a mitzvah, whether small or large. What a beautiful, what a simple idea. Every single day of your life, always be conscious to do a mitzvah. You can do more than one, but for sure every day, and we always do, you know, we're always doing mitzvahs, even not intentionally. The point is here to intentionally do a mitzvah today. Today I'm doing a mitzvah. The Baal Shem Tov's teaching. It doesn't have to be big. He says, whether big or small, or small or large. You should remember that it says, be cautious with a light mitzvah as you are with a strenuous one. Read cautious, zahir, as illuminating, zohar. That is, your soul is illuminated. It says, heavy zahir. The original phrase is, heavy zahir b'mitzvah kala kevachamura. Be zahir, be careful with an easy mitzvah as you are with a difficult mitzvah. But zahir also means shining and radiant. You will be as radiant with a mitzvah kala, with an easy mitzvah, as you are with a large mitzvah. So that is, your soul is illuminated by a light mitzvah just as it is by a strenuous one. For God desires the heart. Rachmana liba ba'i. God, it's not about how tough the mitzvah is or how big the mitzvah is. It's just your dedication and consistency. Let's continue. Remember that it is said, one who keeps a mitzvah will never know from evil. You know the phrase, an apple a day keeps the doctor away? A mitzvah a day keeps the evil away. That's literally what he's saying. Read keeps as awaits. That is, you should always await the opportunity to perform a mitzvah from evening until morning. As the verse states, God is kind all day. So every single day, look for mitzvah opportunities. At least one, he says, a day, if not more. And in this way, we can emulate the life of Sarah. And we can do something to inject each day with faith and meaning and significance and good deeds and virtue. Let's continue. More lessons. So that's lesson number one is, do a mitzvah. Do it consistently. Do it every single day. Or it could be a different mitzvah, but consistently do a mitzvah every single day. Let's look at some more texts. We're going to skip text 14. We're going to skip text 15. And we're going to jump to text number 16. This, again, comes from the Zohar, from Kabbalah, page 79. Look what it says. I'll read the rest of the text. For 6 days you shall work, the Torah says. Sheshes yamim te'asa melacha. 6 days you shall work. What is the work of the 6 days? What kind of work? What happens? No, but listen to the mystical interpretation. Says Rabbi Yossi, the verse literally says, 6 days did God create the heaven and the earth, rather than in 6 days. It says, 6 days God created the heaven and the earth. It doesn't say, in 6 days God created. This establishes that every single day has its own unique work. In other words, what the Zohar says, it doesn't say that God created the world in 6 days. It says God created the work of 6 days, which means that every day has its own form of avodah. Every day has its own unique service. What the avodah, the service of Sunday, is not necessarily the same as Monday, and Monday is not the same as Tuesday. But what is consistent? Every day is different. But what's consistent? Every day I'm doing something. Every day I'm serving my Creator. No matter what the day throws at me, and mystically, Sunday is associated with chesed, divine kindness. And Monday is associated with gevura, with divine sternness and severity. You ever wonder why Monday mornings feel so miserable? It's all the gevura in the air, baby. Right, we think because we're back to work. No, it's because of gevura. This is my own insight. Don't take this seriously. Don't take this as a necessary thing. This may or may not be true, but this is my idea. So Sunday is associated with chesed, loving kindness. It's beautiful. Monday is associated with sternness and severity and strictness. Okay, it feels maybe a little bit more uncomfortable. Tuesday is associated with compassion, etc. And we go on throughout the Sefirot. The point is that based on the radiance, based on the energy, the divine energy that pulses through the universe on that day, it's going to feel different. Days don't feel the same, they feel different. Some days you feel high, some days you might feel low. But what is consistent? God did His work on each of the days, and you and I also have to do our work on each of the days. And it might be a little bit different, because our work may be needed to respond to that specific task at hand. Sunday's work may be different than Monday's work. I know for me, Sundays I'm running Hebrew school. Mondays, I'm not running Hebrew school. I'm doing other things, right? So Sunday mornings I teach a class. And everyone, we all have our own things that we do on different days. The main thing is, though, that each day we're investing with work. Each day we're thinking about something noble to do, something divine to do, something of a mitzvah to do. Each and every single day. Now, we have a few more texts. I want to round out the discussion. So again, message number one is, do a mitzvah each day. A mitzvah day keeps the negative away. I don't want to say evil, right? Keeps the negative away. Hey, tonight is what it is tonight. I saw what's going on in the streets. Mitzvah day keeps the ghosts away. I'm kidding. There are no ghosts, right? Keeps good things happening. That's lesson number one. It's takeaway number one. Takeaway number two is each day might feel different. But what's consistent about it is the work that needs to be done. Whatever day it is, do the work of that day. Respond and do the work. Text 17. Let's continue. This is amazing. Along those lines regarding Sarah's life. As the Midrash explains, the Rabbeinu Bachaya, 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. When she was 100, she was as 20 in sin. And when she was 20, she was as 7 in beauty. We had that before. Rashi also quoted that. Let's continue. The meaning of this comparison is that her beauty waxed and grew when she was 20. Remember, we were wondering, what does it mean that she was as beautiful as 7? Like, what's 7? Because his point is that, is he about to say, sometimes it can be said, I'm not saying this, by the way, I am definitely not saying this, but some might say that beauty begins to decline after 20 or after the 20s. I am definitely not saying this, right? So therefore, what are we saying about her? So her beauty waxed and grew when she was 20, which is normally the time of stable adulthood. Oh, he says stable, not decline. Okay, let's say plateaus. Just like a 7-year-old is still growing. Just like a 7-year-old is still growing and mature, it's physically growing. So too, when she was 20, her beauty was still growing. And that's a nice insight into the comparison between the 20 and the 7 for beauty. And that explains what we perhaps struggled with before. But here's the real kicker, the last two lines. The days of a human being are divided into youth, adulthood, and old age. Right? There's childhood, there's adulthood, and then there's older age. Youth is a time of growth and ascension. Adulthood is stability. It's plateauing. And old age, he says, is a time of withering and descent. The point is, right? So we go up, we go across, and then things become a little bit more difficult. But here's the point. No matter what life throws at us, no matter what stage we're in, there's always the work to get done. There's the challenge of childhood. You think kids know that they have it easy? You think about a child, no responsibilities. I mean, just go to school and just, you know, if you're there anyway, listen to the teacher and learn something. Like, it shouldn't be so complicated, right? And yet, there's so many challenges with children. Children have a world of challenges. And an adult might say, you think those are challenges? You want to go to work and pay the bills? These are challenges. And then an elder might say, right? Somebody in old age might say, you think adulthood? You think middle ages are... Middle ages sounds like a historical kind. But you think middle age is difficult? Try dealing with the health challenges and other challenges of old age. Every stage brings a challenge. The point is not to compare which one is harder, which one is better, or whatever. The point is, it's not a contest. The point is that life takes us through different stages throughout our lives. And not only life as a whole, but also each day, as we said before, takes us through different stages. A Sunday is not like a Tuesday, and a Tuesday is not like a Thursday. Every day is different. But what needs to be consistent is our dedication to that which is true and to that which is good. And this will take us to our last text. Text number 18. And this is the quote from the Rebbe's talk, where the Rebbe asks the question that we began with and provides the answer that we've been building up to. Let's begin text 18. It seems very strange. How is it possible, the Rebbe asks, that all 127 years of Sarah's life were equal in goodness? Certainly we cannot compare her state and standing in Orkastim, or Charan, to that following her arrival in the land that I will show you, which was spiritually much loftier. Right, so she began in a place outside of Israel, Canaan, outside of Canaan. And she went into Israel, which was then Canaan or Canaan, and which was a higher place, even though, again, the daughter-in-law did not come from there, but still spiritually was much loftier. Contrarily, her 127 years included the time spent in the house of Pharaoh and in the house of Avimelech, which, by the way, I forgot to mention before. She was also abducted by Avimelech. So she went through difficult times. So how can we say they were all good? It wasn't all the same. It was different. Rather, the explanation is, the Rebbe explains, at the simple level that the life of Sarah, the name of the parsha, the name of our parsha, our Torah portion, implies those matters in which Sarah was truly alive. And it was in these matters that her years were equal in goodness for all her days. Like the Zohar says about Abraham, that says, each and every one of his days was perfect in the worship of God. In other words, when it came to the physical stuff, there were differences. There were differences. Physically, there were differences. More to eat, less to eat, famine, no famine, Pharaoh's home, not Pharaoh's home. Physically, yes. But inside, she was dedicated and committed. The life of Sarah, in truth, refers not to her bodily life, sleeping and eating or the like. It was not in these matters that Sarah was truly alive. If we're talking about the life of Sarah being 127 years and all good, it doesn't mean her physical life anyway, because that wasn't what Sarah put her stock in to begin with. Certainly the undesirable aspects of dwelling in the house of Pharaoh and the house of Abimelech were not part of the true life of Sarah. And on the contrary, these things caused her much pain. Instead, the true life of Sarah is her spiritual life. This sort of life, the spiritual life, was equal for Sarah every moment she was on this earth. And indeed, this is the lesson of the first verse of our parsha, Torah portion, that even though the days and years of our matriarch Sarah included many distinctions and differences in her state and standing, the true life of Sarah was consistent all her days. They were all equally good. And the message for us, I think, is very powerful, and that is, life throws our way lots of things, lots of curveballs. You think you got something planned, and boom, next thing you know, you're off course. Physically, we can get thrown for a loop. The question is, how do we feel inside? How do we react on the inside? How do we move through life on the inside? Do we do it with fear and anxiety and ups and downs and sideways? Are we thrown all over the place, even inside, or are we able to retain our equanimity, able to retain an even keel, and no matter what life throws at us, we know how to respond with goodness and with faith and with doing our service each and every single day? I want to conclude with one of my favorite stories. It's a story that you probably have all heard, but I need to mention it just because I love it so much and it pertains to our discussion. There were two great Hasidic brothers. I should probably say this on a schedule every single month, once a month, just so that we have it said, because it's such a beautiful story. Reb Zusha and Reb Elimelech. Reb Zusha of Anipoli and Reb Elimelech of Lizhensk. Two great Hasidic masters. They were brothers and they lived in different cities, but they would often travel together. It was the custom of many pious people, at least back in the day, to sometimes put themselves in physically difficult situations in order to, in a sense, pain the body to kind of refine the soul, or pain the body to refine the body. But anyway, they would travel sometimes without any destination, just travel like beggars and kind of put themselves in a place of need and difficulty. So one time they were traveling and they joined up with another group of wanderers and travelers. Before you know it, this was back in the old country, before you know it, the police came by. And they arrested the entire gang. Why? Because the people that Elimelech and Reb Zusha had associated with, they were ganavim, they were thieves. And so they rounded up the whole crew, including our heroes, the two Hasidic mystics. And they all get thrown into the slammer. They get thrown into the prison. And they spend some time there, and they're okay, you know, relatively okay. And at a certain point in time, Reb Elimelech begins putting on his gartel. You know what a gartel is? A gartel is the belt, the black belt. I know, right? Now it's all tangled up in my cords over here. Seems like I'm playing music with my cords. All right, so here's. difficult joke for the end of the class. Right? So this is the gartel. So it's a Hasidic tradition to wear a gartel, and others may wear it as well. I think it's Hasidic. Anyway, he begins putting on his gartel, and his brother Zusha asks him, Rabbi Elimelech, why are you putting on your gartel? He says, because it's time for the afternoon prayers. Got to pray. It looks, you know, it's sun setting. Got to pray before it's too late. Rabbi Zusha says, you can't pray in here. Did you see what's behind us? He looks around and he sees there's a toilet. You know, a prison cell, they put the toilet in the same room. And the halacha is, the law is, you can't pray in a room that has waste in it, that has a toilet. You can't pray in a bathroom. It's not an honorable place to pray. Rabbi Elimelech begins to cry. And Rabbi Zusha says, why are you crying? And he says, I'm crying because I've never missed a mincha my entire life. I've never missed an afternoon prayer. And now, for the first time, because I thought it was all fun and games, you know, we were caught up with this group, they're going to free us anyway. But I'm going to miss a mincha because of this. This is terrible. And he's crying, bitter tears. His brother says, stop crying. The same God that told you to pray also told you, when there's a toilet, not to pray. So by not praying, you're following God's will. The same God that says, pray, says now, right now, in this moment, says, don't pray. And when you don't pray, that's what I want you to do or not do. So he began smiling. And he began laughing. And he began singing. And he began singing with his brother. And they began singing a Hasidic tune, a happy tune, a joyous tune, a tune of celebration. And they did the old Hasidic dance, not this one, but the old, like, arm over arm, help me demonstrate. Throw me, no, give me that arm. No, your right arm. Where you could dance like this around in a circle. They were dancing in a circle in the prison cell, dancing around the toilet. Out of celebration, this is what God wants. This is a mitzvah now to not daven. And they created a commotion. The guards came by after a few moments and said, what's happening? They asked one of the other people in the cell, what's happening? So they said, these crazy Jews are dancing around the toilet. They're dancing around the toilet. It was a bucket. We're going to take it out. So they took it out, and Rabbi Zusha said to his brother, now you can pray. So what's the message of the story? Number one, if you see a bucket with waste, dance around it. Number two, I'm kidding. Your mileage may vary. But really the message is, you know what the message is? Whatever life throws at us, there's a way to serve God in that moment. When there's no bucket, there's one form of service. When there is a bucket, there might be a different type of service. The question is, are we serving God or are we not serving God? Abraham and Sarah, they're the first Jewish couple. And what's the message? Whatever life throws your way, keep on keeping on. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.